because this is our IHS. These are our facilities that are supposed to care for our First People.
A look at the faults and the future of the Indian Health Service. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 12th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, a former Alaska journalist is suing the state's largest paper.
The napkin in this case is essentially an offer.
Is it a paper? It is a paper napkin, yes, Your Honor.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on July 25th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Bernard Memorial Sports Center in Wasilla. The event is open to all. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
President Trump proposes to cut the Indian Health Service budget by $300 million, and the head of the IHS had trouble justifying that 6% cut at a Senate hearing today. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who chaired the hearing, says the chronically underfunded IHS is already failing Native communities in the lower 48, and she says that has to change. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
The acting IHS director would have had a rough hearing anyway. Chairman Murkowski and other members of the Interior Appropriations Subcommittee have spent years shaping the IHS budget. Some represent large Native populations. They weren't likely to welcome cuts to drug abuse treatment, mental health services, clinics, and hospitals in their states. But just last week, the Wall Street Journal put a spotlight on the agency's dire faults. Murkowski says she was horrified to read the journal's accounts of fatal misdiagnoses and inept staff at IHS facilities in the Great Plains.
Because this is our IHS. These are our facilities that are supposed to care for our First People. And the stories that were detailed were shocking.
Murkowski says she's normally laser-focused on home state issues, but Alaska's Native health facilities are run by tribes under contract to the IHS, so their problems aren't the same. Murkowski, though, says the national problems are far too big to ignore. Senator Steve Daines, a Montana Republican, suggested changing the name of IHS to Indian Health Suffering.
These are real families. Single moms, single dads, aunts and uncles, elderly, tribal leaders that are suffering greatly. It's a tragedy.
Acting IHS Director Michael Wiocki acknowledged none of this in his statement at the hearing. He portrayed the proposed cut to his agency as small.
Which will allow us to maintain and address our agency mission to raise the physical, mental, social, and spiritual health of American Indians and Alaska Natives to the highest level.
Murkowski was incredulous.
I know that your job is to defend this budget, but I just have to say wow after listening to that. I would think that we don't have a problem within the IHS system.
Several senators were frustrated IHS didn't provide data on Medicaid reimbursements, the revenue IHS gets when it treats a Medicaid recipient. Murkowski says the information is important because senators are supposed to vote soon on a health care bill that would cut Medicaid without knowing the effect it would have on IHS. John Tester, Montana's Democratic senator, was calm when he started questioning Wiocki.
Were you told not to answer any questions here, by the way?
No, no.
Okay, because I think it's absolutely unbelievable that you can't separate how much money that Medicaid has helped you with third-party billing.
Tester spent a long time trying to get the acting director to answer one specific question.
What does this budget do to your ability to hire staff?
We have a lot of efforts underway.
Is there an increase in dollars for hiring staff or a decrease?
We prioritized maintaining direct care services.
Okay, as far as total dollars go, is there an increase in dollars for hiring staff or a decrease?
Our priority has been...
After a few minutes of that, Tester had had it.
And I'm going to tell you something. Indian Health Service is in a crisis. And if you have served in Indian Health Service for 10 years and you have answered the questions in Indian Health Service like you have here today, it's no wonder that it's in crisis. I cannot believe what has transpired in this hearing today. All I want is some damn answers.
The White House hasn't nominated anyone to head the IHS permanently. Health Secretary Tom Price said at his confirmation hearing he was aware of problems at IHS and wanted to fix them. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The first substantial day of legislative meetings in almost three weeks occurred today, but the two majorities in the legislature were far apart, and not just politically. Most senators met in Juneau for a floor session for the first time since the legislature passed the budget on June 22nd, but most House majority members were out of town. Both bodies agree that the state should stop paying cash for oil tax credits, but the House also wants to reduce companies' ability to use losses to lower their future taxes. The Senate wants to allow this to continue. Anchorage Democratic Representative Garen Tarr says tax reductions should be stopped along with cash credits.
The reason our cash credit system is not working right now is because we can't afford it. We think it's an unreasonable move to put in place a system that we also cannot afford going forward.
While both sides offered up what they described as compromises on oil and gas tax legislation, neither appeared ready to move on the issue of allowing companies to use losses to reduce taxes. Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Giesel says the two sides should move forward with what they agree on, eliminating cash credits. She says using losses to offset taxes is important to attract new oil and gas companies to the state.
We're certainly willing to look at simplifying. It would help our tax division, it would help citizens, it would help legislators if it were a simpler system. But that's not something that happens at 3 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon, 4 days before a special session ends.
Senators say they returned to Juneau to follow legislative rules that allow them to consider the oil tax bill, but House members say they didn't want to waste money on travel if the two sides can't reach an agreement. Special session must end by Saturday. As of 4:20 p.m. today, the conference committee to discuss the bill continued. Last year, ConocoPhillips announced that it wanted to sell its liquefied natural gas plant on the Kenai Peninsula. The company hasn't yet found a buyer, so it's moving to save expenses by mothballing the facility this fall. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more from Juneau.
It's the last piece of infrastructure that ConocoPhillips owns in Cook Inlet, and they're getting closer to shutting it down. The Kenai LNG facility is up against a world market that's awash in natural gas. It's something that ConocoPhillips spokesperson Amy Burnett says is common knowledge.
Most people are fairly aware of the fact that worldwide the price of oil and gas has been low.
Generally, ConocoPhillips is doing well in the oil business in Alaska. The company announced earlier this year a new discovery that could yield up to 100,000 barrels a day in Prudhoe Bay. But it has struggled to make money in the LNG export market.
So over the last few years, more facilities have come online to export LNG. So there are more sources available for the product, which makes competition more difficult.
And the plant has been on hold for a while.
Our last export was actually in the fall of 2015. And since that time, the plant has been in a cold shutdown mode.
But keeping those tanks cold costs money because they have to buy the gas they need to do it. The plan is to let those tanks warm up by leaving them empty. And that means ConocoPhillips will save some money. But it also means that it will take longer and cost more to bring the plant back online. And some people may lose their jobs.
It's too soon to say actually what that's going to look like. There are about 18 ConocoPhillips employees who may be impacted by the change.
That's just over half of the employees currently working at the facility. Larry Persley is an oil and gas advisor for the Kenai Peninsula Borough, where the plant is located. He says that if the company does scale back its operations, it will have an impact beyond the potential loss of jobs.
I guess also a hard reminder to Alaskans that no matter how much we want to sell our oil and gas, if the market doesn't want it, doesn't need it, or isn't willing to pay a price that makes it profitable, we can't sell our oil and gas.
In the last 3 years, prices have tumbled from $15 to $18 per million BTU to just over $5.
You can't buy gas out of Cook Inlet pay to liquefy it, burn up some of it while you're liquefying it, put in a tanker and deliver it for $5.50 per million BTU and make money. It's just, it is a inhospitable market and will be for the near future.
The glut in the global LNG market is a roadblock in the state's efforts to build a pipeline to get Prudhoe Bay's enormous gas reserves to market. And the financial future of that project has been in question for a while. The legislature briefly considered cutting $50 million in funding from the state corporation tasked with developing that project. Mike Chenault is a Republican legislator in the House who represents the area of the Kenai Peninsula where the plant is located. He says they ultimately decided to leave that funding in the budget, in part because the glut won't last forever.
Well, I don't know if that'd ever be viable in the current market, but markets change, and sometimes they change drastically, as we well know, with the price of a barrel of oil or the price of a cubic foot of gas.
Burnett says the company is still negotiating with potential buyers, but she wouldn't say who those buyers were or how those negotiations were going. She says they're confidential. In January, the state's Gasland Corporation disclosed that it was considering the purchase. Any new buyer would need to get a federal export license if it wanted to sell gas to foreign markets. The company's current license expires in February of 2018. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the challenge of bringing indigenous languages onto the smartphone.
Yupik has sounds that English doesn't have, like which is why you can't just speak in Yupik to an English Siri.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Two state commissioners are making big money, even though they don't have much work left to do. That's the story recently reported by Nathaniel Herz with the Alaska Dispatch News. He investigated the state's Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission.
There are some inefficiencies and I think what some would call dysfunction at this agency that have been very clearly and specifically documented in the past two or three years that no one has been able to fix. And that starts at the top.
The commission was created in the 1970s in order to limit the number of boats that can participate in certain commercial fisheries and conserve the stocks. Herz wrote in an article this past weekend that they haven't limited a fishery since 2004 and have processed fewer than five applications per year since 2012.
Basically, the core work that the commissioners have done in the past just doesn't really exist anymore at anything near the level that it once did.
Despite this, Commissioners Ben Brown and Bruce Twomley are each still earning $130,000 per year. Legislators and Governor Bill Walker have made attempts to change the structure and cost of the commission and make it more efficient, but Herz reports that their efforts have failed, in part because of steps taken by commercial fishing interests.
So there's like a real concern that, if you just sort of wrap the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission up under Fish and Game, that somehow, it could be subject to the whims of the Fish and Game Commissioner. It could lose its political independence. It could become less responsive.
Herz spoke with both commissioners who say they have made the agency more efficient.
They've done a lot of cost cutting and sort of reduced unneeded staff that they had there. They are paying, their payroll is down by, I think 10% or more over the past several years since Brown was appointed to the commission.
Ben Brown is on Alaska Public Media's board of directors. You can find a link to Herz's full story, first published in the ADN, through our website, alaskapublic.org. And in other news about news, a Superior Court judge heard arguments Tuesday in a lawsuit against the owner of Alaska's largest newspaper. Alaska Dispatch co-founder Tony Hopfinger is suing the newspaper's current owner, Alice Rogoff, over an agreement he says entitles him to a little more than $1 million over 10 years for his stake in the newspaper. Rogoff, a wealthy former executive at U.S. News and World Report, and Hopfinger, a former journalist, inked the deal on a cocktail napkin in 2014, which presiding judge Andrew Guidi asked about during opening arguments.
The napkin in this case is essentially an offer.
Is it a paper napkin? It is a paper napkin, yes, Your Honor.
Rogoff's attorney, David Gross, argues the napkin does not constitute a contract. Rogoff, through her attorney, also argues that Hopfinger did not keep up his end of the deal anyway and failed to continue helping guide the media company. Hopfinger's attorney says his client was under no such obligation to do work in exchange for the payments and says the napkin contains all the terms that are essential to a contract. Going forward, Judge Guidi could either decide the case himself or send it to a jury for trial. Guidi says his decision will be made in the coming days. Any potential trial would take place in March. The newspaper also faces two other outstanding lawsuits. Cleanup work began this month at a mothballed pump station near Delta Junction that was part of the old Haynes to Fairbanks pipeline. Crews will remove contaminated materials from the timber pump station and two other sites that were part of an old Army-operated pipeline built in the 1950s to transport fuel to the interior's three military bases. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The work at the old pump station near Quartz Lake includes removing soil, equipment, and materiel that were used to help transport fuel from Haynes to Eielson Air Force Base, Fort Wainwright, and Fort Greely while the pipeline was operating from 1954 to 1973. Army Corps of Engineers project manager Beth Astley says most of the 4,000 cubic yards of soil that'll be excavated from the timber pump station was contaminated with the byproducts of burning waste oil in an old disposal pit.
That is the worst of the contamination at that location.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation says the greatest concentration of contaminants was found a few feet below the burn pit. DEC says tainted soil was also found elsewhere around the 5-acre site, both on the surface and underground, down to 22 feet where contaminated groundwater was found. Astley says the Corps of Engineers doesn't know how much fuel leaked around the pump station over those two decades because no single major release was ever reported.
Because there's no catastrophic leak, we can't really come up with a quantity. You know, several, you know, different locations around the pump station appear to have small amounts of fuel entering the soil.
Astley says the project contractor, Anchorage-based Bristol Environmental Remediation Services, also will remove three above-ground fuel storage tanks, the largest of which held up to 59,000 gallons. Also, two underground storage tanks and more than 3,000 feet of above and below-ground pipes used to move fuel around the facility and up the line to Eielson and Wainwright.
So all of those pipelines are being drained and either removed or where they can't be removed, they're being capped and sealed.
Astley says the cleanup contractor began work on the $3.2 million project at the timber pump station on June 29th, right after it had finished work at another old Haynes to Fairbanks pipeline pump station at Scotty Creek near the Alaska-Canada border. And in September, the contractor will begin cleaning up a third site included in the project, an old tank farm near Birch Lake.
The actual work won't start until after Labor Day. Due to the fact that the area is very close to the Birch Lake State Recreation Site, and we don't want to interfere with Labor Day use of the recreation site.
The cleanup site is located on the south side of the lake near a military recreation area. Two big fuel tanks that held up to 277,000 gallons each have been removed from the site, along with associated piping and fueling equipment. But Astley says more testing will have to be done at the site to determine how much soil was contaminated and will have to be removed. Astley says the Corps of Engineers is also trying to wrap up remediation at three other Haynes to Fairbanks pipeline sites at Toke, Sears Creek, near Dot Lake, and the big fuel terminal at Haynes. She says once that's done, the Corps, which has cleaned up 40 sites so far under the program, will be down to its last 10. Several others are being cleaned up through a separate Army program. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
At its regular Tuesday meeting, the Anchorage Assembly adopted a resolution in support of on-site cannabis consumption. The issue is set to go before the state's Marijuana Control Board at its meeting this week in Fairbanks, where three different proposals are on the agenda. The non-binding resolution passed 7-4 and strongly supports the state adopting regulations that could give tourists and patrons a place to consume cannabis products outside private residences. Under municipal rules, public consumption of marijuana products is banned.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Robert Grove had spent 3 years living in a cabin he built in Talkeetna when he decided to return to Fairbanks to find work as a laborer on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is bringing you a series called Midnight Oil about the state's complicated relationship with the pipeline. When Grove went to the labor union hall, he found a job performing hydro tests, a process that flushed water through 25-mile stretches of the pipeline at extremely high pressure. It was a coveted job on the pipeline because it required a lot of hours on the clock.
The first week I went to work was the only week in 2.5 years that I worked less than 80 hours a week. Many times we would work 24 hours a day. I was on a labor crew along with a 798 pipeline crew. Those guys were all out of Tulsa. All of the laborers were all from Alaska. They respected us Alaskans because they all knew we hunted and we were pretty crazy. And these guys all had guns on the pipeline, which was amongst other things that were illegal. And they just thought we did, so they didn't mess around with us. You wouldn't believe the stuff that would come out of that pipe that kind of always wondered where it had come from. I mean, it's chairs and booze and all kinds of clothes, all kinds of stuff. And one night in October, the pipe, it dropped from 45 degrees to 20 below when they had about 20 miles of pipe full of water. And needless to say, everybody freaked out. And Frank P. Moon himself, who was the head of the whole pipeline, landed in a helicopter that morning. And everybody was scheduled to leave the next day. That was supposed to be the last day for the season. And guys were going all over the world to get married, to move on with their lives and whatnot. He knew that, and he basically said to our crew that if you stay here, we're going to be here another month, and we have to wait for a bunch of boilers be trucked up from the oil fields in Alberta, and that we just need to heat up the water that we were pulling out of the Jim River 2 degrees. One of the conditions that Frank Mullen said was, if you stay here and work another month, I will fly you to anywhere in the country that you want to go, and I'll fly you back and make sure that you're the first one called out of the hall in the spring. And he definitely lived up to his word. I was down in Guatemala in Mexico, and got a telegram. I had a message at the Mexican embassy in Mexico City, and I went there and I had tickets to fly back to Fairbanks.
Robert Grove is now retired and lives in Esther. Of all the native languages spoken in Alaska, experts say that Yupik may be the one most likely to be spoken by future generations. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta is keeping its language alive through immersion schools, bilingual media, teacher training programs, and, of course, speaking it at home. Bethel native Christopher Liu is doing his part to bring Yupik into the 21st century. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis has this report.
When we were young, we all recited the Yuyarak at the top of our lungs, all these kids in the middle of the hallway, and it goes, Huankuta Yupikni.
Christopher Liu is reciting a Yupik song that he learned in elementary school.
We, the Yupik people, follow traditional values and principles.
And one of these days, he wants his iPhone to know exactly what he's saying.
We live peacefully, we have faith, and we strive to be strong.
Christopher is a grad student at Stanford studying electrical engineering. He specializes in speech processing and optimization. He's interning at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, also known as NASA, this summer, working on the next Mars Orbiter project. And when he's not crunching numbers at NASA, Christopher's training a computer program to recognize Yupik's speech.
Would you say you're building Yupik's Siri?
I think that's the hope.
Christopher Liu grew up speaking Yupik. His mother's from Nunavichok. He attended Ayapkhun Immersion School in Bethel. In an era of smartphones and increased globalization, he hopes that his speech recognition program will help bring Yupik into the internet age.
Many other people in my generation don't speak Yupik anymore. Everyone's checked into their phones and looking at English media, and having access to Yupik through technology is one way of allowing it to persist and making it easier to use.
But his program faces a number of challenges. Existing speech recognition programs don't really know what to do with Yupik.
Yupik has sounds that English doesn't have, like qa, ch, r. These sounds are not accounted for in English, which is why you can't just speak in Yupik to an English Siri.
And in comparison to many other languages, Yupik's grammatical structure is unique.
You can basically fit two English sentences into one word of Yupik. For example, in English, the phrase, do you want to play cards, would be gashtaryukduden. That whole sentence can be conveyed with just that one word.
So Christopher's training his program to recognize Yupik from scratch, and that means he needs data. If Christopher is going to build Yupik Siri, he needs to compile 100 hours of recorded conversations, fully transcribed, to feed into the software he's writing. So he's asking Calista, LKSD, and other local organizations for help.
I've been fortunate to receive some recordings from KYUK of their Yupik newscast and Yuk to Yuk. If everyone worked together to get to get all the recordings together, and it's not sensitive material, then it would be very helpful.
It's still not clear if Christopher's program is going to work. He says it's a process of trial and error and learning from your mistakes. It can get tedious, but as Christopher goes through hours of tapes, he says his own Yupik is improving.
I've had fun listening to old tapes and old recordings of elders. I get to learn more about traditional knowledge. I always think of samyo. I still don't know yet what it means fully. That was the religion that existed here before Christianity. And I'm still trying to learn what that means. I should know what it means.
For KYUK, I'm Teresa Katsourilis.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Casey Grove and Henry Leisha in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Teresa Katsourilis in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Ann Hillman produced tonight's show. And I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.